Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning, the 17th of July.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn.
This hour of the program, we are going to be over 100 degrees in Milwaukee again today. Southeastern Wisconsin is now in a severe drought, and we are not alone. This crossed the wires yesterday. The 2012 drought disaster is now the largest in over 50 years and among the 10 largest of the past century. And this is covering 54.6% of the contiguous 48 states in drought at the end of June, the highest percentage since December of 1956, and the sixth highest peak percentage on record. Record rain in other parts of the world. Another report last week from that crossed Reuters wire. Climate change, extreme weather, linked in studies examining Texas drought. This is last year, and the heat in the UK. Climate change increased the odds for the kind of extreme weather that prevailed in 2011. And 2011 was a year of extreme events, from historic droughts in East Africa, North Mexico, and southern United States, to an above-average cyclone season in North Atlantic and the end of Australia's wettest two-year period ever. And we'll make our own kinds of records in the year 2012. So this hour of the program, we are going to be talking about the options that may mitigate climate change or help us adapt to it. We have two guests with us this hour. Maggie Fox is president and CEO of the Climate Reality Project, a campaign to help citizens all over the world look at the climate crisis and take steps to bring about change. Maggie has participated in training hundreds of climate educators from around the world, most recently in Beijing, China, and Jakarta. And she serves on the board of the Green Fund and was honored by the Women's Council on Energy and the Environment as the 2010 Woman of the Year. Maggie, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
Professor Christopher Field is also with us, professor of biology, professor of environmental earth science at the Department of Global Ecology, Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford. His research emphasizes impacts of climate change from the molecular to the global scale. He has led many national and international committees related to global ecology and climate change and was elected co-chair of the Working Group 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which released the recent report, Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation. Professor Chris Field, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Good to be with you.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Our phone number, I'm sure we'll have many phone calls during the course of this hour, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's start with you, Professor Field, for just a moment. I enumerated some of the real extreme events that have taken place all over the planet. You have been involved in looking at why these are happening, how we mitigate some of these real extremes. Can you tell us what we need to do to prepare for, response to, and recover from the risks of a warming planet?
Well, dealing with climate change really has two big components. The first component is, what should we do about the changes that have already been baked into the system, the kinds of things that we can't avoid and need to adapt to? And the second phase is, what can we do about climate change that hasn't yet been determined, and how our actions in the future will control how much the climate changes? For the first category, the category of things that are already baked into the system, there are really three big categories of response: preparing for disasters, responding to disasters effectively when they occur, and recovering effectively. And with all of those things, there are smart, effective, not always expensive steps that can be taken, and there are steps that can be taken with responsibilities by a wide range of actors. For the second class, the class of limiting the climate change that occurs in the future, there are a wide range of decisions that can be made, and right now I think the world's at a really critical juncture of trying to understand the options, their costs, and their consequences.
Maggie, I know you've trained people in climate education from around the world. What do you teach them?
Well, we believe there's a sort of a fundamental threshold that you have to reach, which you're speaking of on this show, and probably most, if not all, of your listeners are with us, and that is that climate change is real, it's happening, it's man-made, and the linkages between all the events that Chris referred to as those that are baked into the system are there, and we have to actually, you know, understand those and then make respond not just to the things that are already occurring and are will occur in the short term, but actually look ahead. So first we talk about climate science and giving our leaders an opportunity to be grounded very firmly in the evidence-based impacts of climate change that are already happening all over the world. And then the second is to learn how to talk to people about it. Right now, in the United States in particular, but in other parts of the world, there's still a denial game going on, and that has a serious impact on our ability to step forward and aggressively, openly discuss this challenge and deal with the second category that Chris is talking about, the action, our actions now and in the future that will enable us to manage the impacts and hopefully mitigate, if not avert, some of the impacts of climate change in the future.
Chris, when you look at the news, I tend to watch the news every night. I am just amazed how over the past few months the stories have been dominated by fires in Colorado, extreme drought, we're experiencing it here, extreme heat in the United States, incessant rain in Europe. And you never hear a whole lot of analysis of why this is happening and what we ought to do about it. Why is it that we don't hear that? Is it just that most people are saying, well, this is just the way things are, this is normal kinds of patterns, this is horrendous, and we're very sorry this is happening to people, but we'll get through this somehow? There's never a discussion of all of the factors that may contribute to this and what it is that we need to do to move forward.
Well, it is really heartbreaking to see the kinds of disaster losses that we've experienced in the U.S. and worldwide. And I think it's natural that in the midst of a catastrophe, people focus on getting through the catastrophe. The pattern that's important for people to recognize, however, is that if we look back through history, we've seen clear trends in the kinds of climate extremes that we're seeing in the U.S. this summer. We've seen clear trends in high temperature extremes, the things that cause heat waves. We've seen trends in the fraction of rainfall that falls in the heaviest precipitation events, the kind of events that can cause floods. In many parts of the world, we've seen increases in the length or the severity of droughts. And in coastal areas around the world, we've seen increases in extremes that are associated with high sea level, basically storm surge. That pattern is really very, very clear, and the patterns that we're seeing now are an expression of these climate trends that have been built into the system.
The report that was issued, and you were co-chair of this working group, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the main message, the report says, is that we know enough to make good decisions about managing the risks of climate-related disasters. Sometimes we take advantage of this knowledge. Many times we do not. Maggie Fox, when have we taken advantage of this knowledge throughout the world?
Oh, there's good examples. There are not as many as we need, but there are good examples. Most recently, earlier this year, President Felipe Calderon of Mexico signed a comprehensive national climate change legislation which makes Mexico the first newly industrialized country to enact a comprehensive climate law. Last year, in November, the Australian Parliament passed a law to set a price on carbon, and they're in the implementation phase. Here in the United States, in California, you know, they passed a state law, which is commonly referred to as AB 32, which is a climate change legislation, and state of California is in the regulatory process of putting that together. Certainly in China and India and a lot of Europe, there are a lot of very aggressive policy changes going forward. We would not say that's true in the United States. We certainly don't have comprehensive legislation out of our Congress. We obviously tried that in the first year, 2 years of the Obama administration. We weren't able to move that forward. So there are good things happening in the world. But it's not at the scale that we need to respond to this challenge. The good stories are very good in some cases, the attempts by the fossil fuel industry to undo the good are ferocious, block the change where it starts to happen and when it does happen to try to undo it. But still, people, we are moving forward. It just is not happening at the rate and at the scale that we need.
Professor Field, you want to add to that?
If we look at disaster responses, there are some really good examples that demonstrate how every disaster really has three components. It has one component that's due to the hazard, to the physical event. It has one component that's due to the exposure, how much stuff is in the way of the disaster, assets, people. And it has another component that's due to vulnerability, how at risk, how prepared, how resilient are the people. And there are ways to address extremes by dealing with all three of those components. Disaster risk really emerges from their overlap. And many of the best examples of dealing effectively with disaster risk come from places where you wouldn't necessarily expect it. Bangladesh is actually a great example of a society that's prepared itself for damaging cyclones. In the 1970s and 1990s, cyclones hit Bangladesh that killed hundreds of thousands of people, were horrible disasters. In 2007, when Bangladesh had Cyclone Cedar, they had implemented a variety of early warning systems and protective locations that played a dramatic role in limiting deaths. 4,000 people were lost in Cyclone Cedar, a horrible loss of life. But the very next year, a similar cyclone hit Myanmar, a country that had very little experience with tropical cyclones, and over 130,000 people were killed. Mm. What we see in the case of this example is that smart, low-cost actions can make a huge difference.
Such as?
Well, in Bangladesh, they really did three things. They organized volunteer group to make sure that word was out that storm surge was coming. They built a number of structures that people could gather in that allowed them to be away from the storm surge. And then finally, they created some elevated plots of land where farmers could get their livestock, and resulted in huge savings. And these relatively modest steps didn't cost the society a lot, but they had a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. Maggie, I don't know if you've had a chance to be in the Midwest, although this is now covering most of the country, but I was reading just this morning, it's something every day, but this news that the 2012 drought disaster is now the largest in over 50 years in this country, and it's covering 54.6% of the contiguous 48 states. That is huge. How should we be responding to that? Do you see that as a clear indication of climate change, and can you make the connection that we are causing that?
Well, I think Professor Field is going to be a lot better as a trained climate scientist to make the proper linkages there. But what I would like to do instead, or at the same time, actually, not rather instead, is to point out that these patterns of extremes, as Professor Field has pointed out, are the new normal.
Mm-hmm.
And that while there are really important, as he articulated, responses to be made to these kinds of extremes, whether it's extreme drought or in the case of Bangladesh that he was speaking of, storm surges, I happen to live in Colorado. Like you, I'm in a state where climate change has having dramatic impact.
Yes.
Earlier this summer, one of the many fires that were started simply by a lightning strike was less than a mile from my home at on the backside of a peak that I see out of most of the windows in my house. So there's several ways to talk about this. One is the very wise way that Professor Field is talking about. Like, look, these things are happening, and we need to focus on them and get support and systems, and not all of them require massive amounts of money, to people in the Midwest or in other parts of the world where these kinds of extreme weather events are creating significant havoc. One, and that's not an unimportant conversation. I spent most of yesterday and part of this weekend at a natural hazards conference that's occurring in Colorado, a national conference, with people from FEMA and lots of other organizations talking about just what Professor Field is talking about. So how do we handle this? Where are the budget items? What can we get to people? What are the early warning signs, et cetera? That's one, and that's really important because I now have an experience of that vulnerability, just like all of the farmers and others in the Midwest are experiencing every day. You don't know when it will end. You don't know what you will have at the end. It's very, very terrifying. Whether it's a storm surge or a drought or a massive storm that reeks through your community and turns homes upside down and leaves you like, what happened to me? Mm-hmm. What happened to our life? The next is to think about why this is happening. This is not, as Chris was saying, this is not, these random acts of climate action that have occurred over the century. This is a pattern that has emerged, and it will continue to emerge as a result of man-made climate change impacts. And therefore, while we look at the very immediate moment, we have to connect the dots here. We have to actually say, okay, I have to operate on multiple levels. I have to look at these challenges that are right in front of me in my state, in your state, many others around the country and around the world, and get to work on that. But I also have to stop doing this. Mm-hmm. I have to actually get on the front side of this challenge, talk about it, get in conversation with others about it, acknowledge these linkages, help people make these linkages, and demand solutions. Because while every one of us needs to take responsibility for our own carbon footprint, even if we did that, every one of us, we still need government action at a broad policy level to make the kind of changes we need to make to reduce not just future carbon pollution, but the impacts of carbon that are in the atmosphere, as Chris pointed out, that are baked into the system. So we actually have change that's happening now and inevitably will continue to happen as a result of carbon pollution. But we also have to stop polluting. 90 million tons of carbon pollution are dumped in the atmosphere every day. We can't keep doing this.
There will be a lot of people who will say that we can't accept this as a new normal. It destroys our livelihoods. We can't live in climates where it's 105 degrees and you got tourism that's suffering. You've got all kinds of things suffering. So they will say this cannot be the new normal. We just can't live this way. So, Professor Field, how do we get on the front side of the challenge?
Well, in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the group that I work with, we've been basically asked by the world's governments to provide a comprehensive overview of what the scientific community does and doesn't know about the causes of climate change, the impacts, and what you can do about it in a way that is policy relevant but not policy prescriptive. Essentially, our job is to lay out the information and the policy choices so that stakeholders all the way from families that make decisions about what kind of vehicle to purchase to governments or international organizations can make decisions about treaty obligations in a way that's smart, that's responsive to the information, that recognizes where the costs are and where the benefits are. And if you go all the way from the kinds of extreme events that we've been talking about to long-term progressive loss of ice sheets, there really are smart, effective decisions that can be made at every level that have the potential to deal effectively with the problems that are occurring now, to reduce the prevalence of those problems in the future, and to avoid the most serious aspects of climate change farther in the future.
What are those choices?
Well, I think as Maggie says, in the long term, what we really need to decide is how we're going to deal with the problem of essentially using the atmosphere as a waste dump. We are achieving remarkable things as a consequence of the active global economy, but there are a lot of unfortunate consequences. The way I think about it is that the global economy is like a truck going down a highway of life, and it's producing all kinds of benefits, but it's also dumping nails out of the back. And the consequence of those nails on the highway is that everybody follows this global economy is going to have to deal with the consequences of those nails. There are a bunch of things we can do. We can adapt. We can get better tires. We can have vehicles that are more crash resistant. we can mitigate, we can find ways to decrease the rate at which nails are falling on the road, or we could, it's called geoengineer. We could basically put a piece of paper over the road so that you didn't know that the nails were really there. Mm. And in the long run, there are many benefits to adaptation, but there are also many limitations. If you don't have the financial resources to do the adaptation, it's a real challenge. And I think that for the long run, what we really need to do is figure out how we're going to find ways to decrease the rate at which we're polluting the atmosphere, at which the nails are going onto the road, in a way that's not crippling to the economy. And there are lots of options.
And so the obvious question is, why don't we move ahead on it? And we'll get the answers to that question in a moment. We'll also start taking your many phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about extreme weather disasters and how we get on the front side of the challenge that is before us to deal with climate change and all that we are doing to add junk to the atmosphere and make this these kinds of disasters even worse. We have two guests with us this hour. Christopher Field is founding director of the Carnegie Institute's Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University and co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 2. Maggie Fox is president and CEO of the Climate Reality Program. She also spent 20 years working at the Sierra Club. Here's the number again. Our phones are busy. Keep the number in your head, though. You'll be able to get through eventually. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Leave messages on our Facebook page as well. This is an important issue that I don't think we're talking about enough, and it would be interesting to hear your comments that we can contemplate when the show is over, or we'll use some of the comments on the air. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, historian Douglas Brinkley will be joining us. He has written a thorough and captivating account of the entire life of Walter Cronkite. The book is Cronkite. We'll talk about Walter Cronkite, hour two of our show. All right, to your phone calls now. Amanda in Madison. Hi. Amanda, are you there? Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. Yesterday, CBS News talked about the drought in the Midwest, and they talked about why we have the drought also, and that is because the El Niño current is warmer than usual and is pushing the jet stream further north than it has been since 1959, I believe. And this is the reason we have the drought in the Midwest. Can you tell me how much warmer the water is in the Pacific?
Professor Field.
Well, every time we have an extreme climate event, we can look at the proximal causes, the short-term things that are causing it, or we can look at the longer-term consequences. And we're just working through the understanding of the current drought in the Midwest, and it certainly is connected in the short term with ocean conditions, but it's also connected in the longer term with the big climate trends that we've been seeing. And I think it's important to recognize that even though we can come up with a detailed explanation of the particular weather factors that are producing and sustaining a drought, that it's fitting into a pattern that has a component due to long-term global-scale climate changes.
I want to get back to these policy decisions that we need to act on. There are two parts to the question. Maggie, let's put this to you first. What is it that would make the biggest impact on all of this in terms of industry? I don't know, maybe individual responsibility, but address both of those. And the second part of the question is, why in the world we aren't doing that right now?
Well, can I go to the second question first? Because I think it has enormous impact on the
sure.
The first one. First of all, in the United States and in other parts of the world, notably the United Kingdom and in Australia and some other places, there's a very active, aggressive industry of denial.
Mm-hmm.
Before we can get to the significant and important debate about how to, as to borrow Chris's analogy, about realizing these, the nails that are being dropped onto the highway from the free market economy roaring down the highway of life. I hope I didn't butcher that, Chris. The truth is, this denial industry has put a huge block in front of us. You know, first, climate change doesn't exist. Climate scientists are out there reaping they're all about getting money. They're all about these absurd notions that climate scientists are some sort of evil henchmen perpetrating these myths. And there is no such thing as climate change. And if it is, it's simply not man-made. It's all part of natural cycles. Or if you go past that to, they're telling us these evidence-based information is really not viable. It's all part of natural cycles. All sorts of ridiculous myths. There's a group of scientists that I know Chris knows of, a website called Skeptical Science out of Australia, which they just put together over 100 myths that are perpetrated by the denial industry. This is very similar, and in fact exactly the same think tanks and the same money as the denial of the cancer-causing impacts of tobacco, which took many, many years to undo. Putting doctors on television saying, of course cigarette smoking is good for your health. No, we don't have climate change. So there's this huge industry of denial. So this show is an important piece of that. We have to deal with this, and we have to come clean and get the truth on the table. We are using the atmosphere as a dump, and we can't continue to do it because it has already had and will continue to have significant negative impacts to all aspects of our planet. Us as human beings, to our ability to feed ourselves, to animals, to natural cycles around whether the La Nina or El Nino and how they operate. We're melting the ice caps. So it's a very, very, very big challenge. But first you've got to remove denial. You've got to step beyond it and push it aside. Interestingly enough, Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, in February of this year, I said, oh, yes, climate change is happening, after being a principal funder of the denial industry for many, many years, but then quickly followed it by saying, oh, but it's not really a big problem. Engineering will take care of it. Well, I think as you can see from the Midwest, and we can see from Colorado or around the world, some of these problems are not just about engineering. They're about making change and changing the way we operate and produce energy going forward. And so what are the policy options? They range from what we call the fee and dividend. There are a lot of different ways to do it. At some point, there's a fundamental decision to be made to put a price on carbon, to cap carbon pollution. That is a core element of all policy choices. There are renewable energy standards that have popped up all over the country, and they are making a difference in terms of incentivizing and building opportunities for states to build on a renewable clean energy standard. So there are 29 states in the United States that have mandatory clean energy targets. There may be a proposal on the ballot in Michigan in November to establish a renewable energy standard. Wisconsin has a target that works out to about 10% by 2015. In your state, apparently it varies specifically by utility. There are a number of choices that we can make, and they are very important, and they need discussion and debate, and there will be citywide, countywide, state-based, and national and international solutions. But in order for that debate to reach the kind of scale that it needs for everyone to be talking about this, because it impacts every one of us, we first have to push denial aside. So this conversation today, this show, and the leadership you're showing, Kathleen, and that of Wisconsin Public Radio, is to get this stuff out on the table and talk about it and help build these linkages, not only to the specific events that are causing people pain today, yesterday, tomorrow, but the pain that we can avert in the future by making better policy choices in how we produce and use energy.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about those policy choices, Professor Field? Would you want to add to them or amplify on those?
You know, when I look at the solution set for dealing with climate change, it's important to remember that it really has many dimensions. I kind of think of the solution space as being a house with four walls. One wall is conservation. There are really things that we can make decisions about whether we really need, things we can do without. Do we really need to make one more trip to a business meeting, or can we do it by Skype? Mm-hmm. The second wall is efficiency. There are amazing gains to be had in increasing the efficiency, decreasing the energy and carbon requirements of many kinds of activities, all the way from vehicles that don't use fossil fuels or get more miles per gallon, all the way to buildings that are better insulated. Wonderful opportunities at the demand side. When we look at the supply side, there are also a wide range of technologies that can be deployed to decrease the rate at which we're dumping carbon into the atmosphere. Some of those involve capturing and storing the carbon that's used for energy. Others involve renewables. And I think it's really important to find ways to nurture and to encourage a broad set of options in the solution space, whether it's better insulated buildings or more effective deployment of a grid that can accommodate high levels of solar and wind into the system.
Let's go to Paula in Janesville. Hi, Paula.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
I am thinking, listening to those professors, that we're going to have to do something about the political out here. Fight the Republican fighting to give money to the billionaire. The billionaire ought to have his money cut short because it's like little big brother hitting little sister with a fire truck. It can't always be the consumer that can do something about it. It's these giants that need to be stopped.
Maggie, you want to start?
Well, I actually think, to go back to Chris's four-walled house, I'm thinking maybe the first wall was conservation, the second was efficiency, the third was a variety of technologies, the fourth maybe was R&D. Was that it, Chris?
It certainly could be. Sure.
Well, fix me if I'm not correct about that. But to the specific question, these are... We've made societal decisions around the use of fossil fuels as a not just primary but almost in many cases exclusive source of energy in many parts of the world. The cost, fossil fuel has been very effective at moving the world forward, but there are significant costs which are not currently being borne or even understood or accepted. Whether or not it's at the high end or at the low end of the economic cycle, climate change impacts all of us, but it affects the poorest of the poor most and most negatively. How we manage those things going forward is really going to be a big shift in questions that we have to answer as societies. But the first thing, if you go back to the question, the way Chris put it together of this four-walled house, whether... When you're talking about conservation, that is both a individual decision and a decision that goes all the way up the food chain to those who are the wealthiest who can actually implement these conservation measures at a broad scale to the point of the questioner. On the efficiency side, asking and demanding that people who own vast resources in the fossil fuel industry do a much better job of delivering energy in more efficient ways is part of the policy choices that we have to make. And the same is true on the supply side. So I think those who have the greatest resources actually have the capacity to have a bigger impact.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. But those decisions are going to have to be made at the national and international level.
Thank you, Paula, for the call. Lars is next. Hi, Lars.
Good morning. I'm a farmer, and I noticed I was running the 88. We had the drought. 88?
Yes.
4 years ago. Well, anyway, I know it's every year after the 88 drought that planting season seems like it moved up a few weeks. Like, now, years ago, you never would think of be planting corn until the 1st of May. Nowadays, it's 15th of April, somewhere in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's on hay crop now. Years ago, you'd be lucky if you get two crops, and now they can get three to four crops. It seems like within that 20-year span, it's putting higher than the seasons are all out of whack,
kind of. How are you faring this summer, Lars?
Good. I planted most of the stuff earlier, early, and the later stuff, well, I kind of have to go with the early stuff and leave the later stuff go.
Right.
You know, it's just like it's a pick and choose. You know, you either do this or you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. What part of the state are you in?
Pardon?
What part of the state are you in?
Over by Dodgeville, southwest corner.
Okay. Professor Field.
Well, I think Lars makes an extremely important point, which is that we've now seen enough climate change in many parts of the world that many of us as individuals have personal experience with the way the climate's changed. Lars describes a change in the planting date for his crops. That's something we've seen certainly very strongly in many areas in the United States. And there are some times when this longer growing season has resulted in increases in crop yields, and sometimes when it's resulted in decreases in crop yields. But I think it's a really important turning point when most of us can say, yes, I have personal experience of climate change. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing its effects on my life.
Well, and all you have to do is observe the natural world, and almost everybody can see that things are blooming a lot earlier, or there are different kinds of animals. The manifestation of change is pretty obvious to somebody who's an observer of the natural world, wouldn't you say, Maggie?
Yes, it's very obvious. But I mean, there are two or three things that we haven't talked about this morning, and one is social psychology, you know, social science, and what we're like as human, how we respond. First of all, the evidence in the natural world is increasing every day. And if you have a garden, not necessarily as large a farmer, but if you have a garden, whether it's a flower garden or a vegetable garden, whatever, even some parts of your property that you grow things on, you can see these changes. And each year they become more and more visible. So it's not something that changes and goes back to normal the next year. It's a pattern that's repeating itself over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
When you see what's happening with these extreme weather events in your communities, in your state, in your region, and around the world, these are very powerful touchstones that push against the industry of denial, telling you this is really not happening. Or the other narrative is, if it's not happening, we've got your back. Not to worry. The fossil fuel industry will take care of you. Well, actually, that's not the case. And so we actually have to stand up as individuals and say, we see these changes, and while we can't stop, I want to go back to something you said earlier where, Kathleen, where you said people are saying, look, we can't do this 105-degree temperatures. It's affecting our livelihoods.
Right.
It's affecting the way we function, our work and our tourism industries and many, many other industries. That isn't really our choice right now. This is actually, the patterns have been built in, baked in. Once again, to borrow Chris's phrase, what we have choices about is how do we handle them and how do we act going forward. And recognizing these very close-in impacts and having them give you the power as an individual to say, okay, I see this and I want action.
Right, right. You talked earlier, Maggie, about putting a price on carbon. We haven't talked very much about cap and trade. Can you address that, Christopher Field, what that is exactly, how effective it might be? Is there one? Do both have to happen? Is one better than the other, cap and trade or a carbon tax?
The way to think about it is that there are prices, costs of polluting the atmosphere that we're not reflecting in the prices that we pay for goods. When we buy gasoline at the pump, we're not paying the cost of the damages that the CO2 from that gasoline is doing on the climate. And putting a price on carbon basically means figuring out a way to include more of the real costs in what we pay. You can do that with a tax, or you can do it with various other kinds of tools, of which cap and trade is one of the most widely discussed. Cap and trade is essentially the same as a tax. It's a little bit different in that you say, okay, we will let actors in the economy decide how to come up with the best solutions that they can come up with so that emissions stay below a certain limit. The important thing to recognize is that whatever kind of financial implements we use, we're basically trying to reflect something closer to the real cost of the energy we're using rather than what you can think of as a subsidized cost. Currently, the real impacts of our energy decisions are being subsidized. They're being borne through impacts on nature. And what we want to do is move to a situation where the real costs are reflected in the price we pay.
More phone calls in just one moment. Our guests this hour are Christopher Field, founding director of the Carnegie Institute Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University. Christopher is co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 2. They just issued a major report on this issue, looking at the whole world. Maggie Fox, president and CEO of the Climate Reality Project. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Yet a new report today that the 2012 drought disaster is the largest in over 50 years, and it is having an impact on 54.8% of the contiguous 48 states in this country. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. Lars, thank you so much for your call. It was an important one. It's good to hear from people who are actually living this as farmers. We're all living it in our own ways, aren't we? 800-486-8655 is the number. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Douglas Brinkley on Cronkite, his thorough examination of the life of Walter Cronkite, who was witness and really voice of so many important news events in the 20th century. Willem in Colfax, hi.
Hello. I was calling because I've gardened for over 30 years, and I've noticed the changes that are happening from season to season, and all the changes that have been happening in our climate. And when I've expressed these concerns to our political leaders, in particular Senator Ron Johnson, I wrote him, and he wrote me a letter back about how there are world-renowned climatologists who deny that this is happening. It would be foolish, economically foolish, to make changes, and that it's immoral, and all this kind of language. And when I wrote or called my senator, Senator Terry Moulton, in the area where I live, he said to me that it was fear-mongering. And in our state of Wisconsin, they're doing a lot against, they're making it very difficult for the wind energy to progress by, you know, set-asides and distance from property lines. But at the same time, and this is because I think they have their head in the sand, literally, they're more than happy to turn what used to be rural western Wisconsin, often called God's country, into a industrial sand mining area where this sand is trucked using enormous amounts of diesel and fossil fuels to move it from one location to another location and potentially ship it all over the world in this fracking operation. So I think in this case, it's sort of ironic also that a Republican like Ronald Reagan once said that government is not the solution, it's the problem. In this case, I think all the funding by people like Americans for Progress and the Koch brothers, who are heavily invested in the gas and oil industry and who support people like Ron Johnson and our governor and all that are working very hard to convince people that this is not a problem. And
all right, Maggie.
Well, first of all, I think you're taking important steps by making these calls and writing these letters, and it's not very encouraging to get the responses that you've gotten, but that doesn't mean that you need to stop doing it. It's really important to step up and speak out. You do know this is happening. You have evidence in your own life, and you can see through your own eyes and through the kind of education that you're putting yourself through. So let me just say, as a sort of a point, it's going to take citizen action in every community and in every state of this country to stand up to the denial industries turning a blind eye or teaching our elected officials to stick their heads in the sand. The truth of the matter is that this notion of it being an economic disaster to act on climate change, it's the exact opposite. It is going to be an economic disaster if we do not take action, because the changes that are already baked into the system and that are coming if we don't stop using our atmosphere as a dumping ground are much more serious than the kind of economic changes that we have to work our way through as we shift to cleaner forms of energy. So I applaud you for speaking up and for making these connections and reaching out to others to help them make them. We are going to have to demand this change. We're going to have to stop the denial industry from spreading these lies and actually get the truth on the table so that we can solve these problems and actually move forward into a 21st century with a clean energy economy instead of a dirty fossil fuel economy.
Professor Field, how do we get our U.S. Congress to examine this issue seriously? Some are saying that it simply is the most important issue of our times. We would like to have Congress put all the facts on the table, look at this, the long-term ramifications of what could happen to the planet, and the short-term of how we deal with disasters that are affecting so many people in this country. How do we get the kind of attention that many people say we need from those who represent us?
I think probably the most important element is for citizens to help their elected representatives realize that climate's not a partisan issue. There aren't Democratic or Republican thermometers.
No, it's not. Yeah.
And the solution is going to have challenges and opportunities for people from across the political spectrum. Maggie just spoke to the great economic opportunities that are represented by a transition to a low-carbon economy. And I think that one of the things that we really haven't talk sufficiently about is what are the leading economies of the 21st century going to look like? Where are the opportunities for being a leading economy? And I think that we, the people in the United States, the government of the United States, wants to position us so that we're global leaders through the century. And that means recognizing where the challenges are and recognizing where the opportunities, and many of the opportunities are in building the energy system of the 21st century. And that's going to look very different than the energy system we have now, but it represents vast economic opportunity.
And it's not as though we haven't been talking about it for years and years and years now. We have talked about it. We just don't do very much about it. Let's go to Willem. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Sue, and we're running short on time. Hales Corners. Hi, Sue.
Hi, thanks. I'm a military veteran who cares about climate change. And to me, it seems doubtful we'll see any successful bipartisan legislation unless we can bring the conversation to a level of national security. And I'm wondering if you see that conversation starting to happen.
Maggie.
It absolutely is happening, and thank you for calling in. As you probably know, because you are a military veteran, the Department of Defense has the largest clean energy budget in the United States. many years ago, under both the Bush administration and under this administration, our Department of Defense looked at the national security implications of climate change and called them out many years ago and began shifting. So much of the important innovation, there's good work, great work happening at the Department of Energy, but the other place where really important work is happening is at the Department of Defense, thank goodness. A lot of the important innovations that we're going to need for technological fixes are coming out of DOD. That's one. And that's a place to take heart. When every year there is a national security analysis, and climate change is in one of the top three threats. And as a result, the Department of Defense and the entire military establishment are making enormous shifts in how we use fossil fuel. And we'll really is giving us the ground in which to build this new 21st century low-carbon economy.
That's worth another show. And we're out of time at this point. I'm sorry. Thank you both so much for such an interesting and very, very important hour. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Our thanks to Maggie Fox, President and CEO of the Climate Reality Project, Christopher Field, Founding Director of the Carnegie Institute's Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University, and co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 2. They issued a major, major report. If you go Google it, you'll be able to find their report because they looked at climate change and all over the world. Thanks for listening. More to come.